Thank you for wrapping this up. Seems very auspicious when you open it like this. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Susan. A little over 10 years ago, I was involved in the operation of a community sawmill in Papua New Guinea. And I was mostly working with managing the forests that they were cutting the timber out of, but I also tried to help whenever I could to help the community sell some of the boards that they cut. As part of this, one time I made a trip to Darien, Connecticut, and went to a very high-end woodworking shop with some samples of wood from New Guinea that I wanted this gentleman to see if he was interested in buying wood from us. And what a great place. He had all of these wonderful machines and boards, everything, and he took us back into one of his workshops, and sitting on two sawhorses was a piece of mahogany that must have been about 40 inches by 7 feet, and it had been carved into a door, and it was one solid piece of mahogany. So it's a piece of mahogany that's about this big and 7 feet tall. And I should give you some background. Mahogany is undoubtedly the most precious tropical timber in the world. The wood is beautiful. It's very solid, but it's easy to work. It's easy to carve. It has been on and off the CITES list, species endangered of extinction list, many times over the past 10 years. And to see a board that large, one board, is very rare. And as a forester, you start thinking about the incredibly skillful life of that Swetenia, that's the Latin name for the tree, Swetenia tree, to be able to live and grow and survive in a tropical forest. This was actually from the Peruvian Amazon where this wood came from. To attain such a large size, to live such a full life. And I was struck by, to be able to do that, trees, and I'm a real fan of trees. Trees are amazing because what they have to do is that every time they are presented with something, they have to respond in exactly the perfect way, or they will eventually die. If there's a tree fall gap that opens up, they have to know immediately to grow in there and occupy that space before something else does. So that the trees, to be able to get to that size in every moment of their life, are forced to manifest what is essential for them in every moment. So we're standing there sort of marveling at this huge board. Everybody's just sort of in reverence of this huge board. And then the door opens and one of the workmen comes out, and he's carrying a can of paint and a brush. And he starts painting this board sort of a pastel blue color while we're sitting there watching it. Now, at the time I was confused or shocked by why anyone would want to paint such an incredible piece of tropical nature. Why would they want to paint over that? More recently, after several years as a Zen student, I am struck by the fact that this is exactly what I do all the time with my life. I paint over something that is inherently pure and perfect with my opinions and prejudices and points of view. And I'm struck that these cherished viewpoints may have absolutely no relationship to the phenomena or the people or the things that I'm actually sharing with my life with in that moment. And furthermore, I'm struck by how my painting everything may not actually be making things better or easier or less confusing or serving in any way to help save all beings at all. And on the off chance that some of you may also be very prolific painters in your life, and given all of the teachings and sutras and poems and scholarly writings that I've found exactly on this topic, some of them are really quite old. I think that human beings probably have been doing this for a long, long time. I've decided this morning to build my talk around this mahogany door. And if the talk had to have a title, I don't know if it has to have a title, but I would like to call it Painting Your Life. From the Identity of Relative and Absolute by Master Sekito Kinzen. All spheres, every sense and field, intermingle even as they shine alone, interacting even as they merge, yet keeping their places and expressions of their own. Forms differ primarily in shape and character and sounds and harsh or soothing tones. The dark makes all words one. The brightness distinguishes good and bad phrases. All sentient beings have evolved a mental ability, a mind tool that helps them survive in this life. It's pattern recognition. Insects have this ability. Lizards have this ability. Mammals are really good at it, like think dogs or pigs. Human beings, however, are the masters of this. So in pattern recognition, what happens is that we see a couple of things, and then we infer something else from them. A mosquito feels a rush of air, maybe senses a shadow, infers that it is being slapped, and immediately flies away, and is always successful at doing that. Or a woodpecker sees rotting bark sloughing off of the trunk of a tree, infers that there may be bark beetles under that, and so starts pecking away looking for food. So human beings have turned this into a very fine art. We see loamy soils, flat terrain, luscious vegetation, and infer that this might be a good place to farm. Or we see a bright neon sign and a full parking lot, and we hear live music and infer that this might be a fun place to eat dinner. Or we get out of a cab in a bad part of town. Now this bad is also inferred through pattern recognition. This looks like a bad part of town. It starts to get dark. The wind picks up, and a whole new set of reflexes kicks in. Now, the adaptive significance of this pattern recognition is, in many cases, it's very clear. Pattern recognition is how we know not to drive through a busy intersection when the light is red. Or how to avoid touching a hot stove. We engage in pattern recognition all the time, and we have been doing this since the day we were born. If this, and this, then that. And we do this sequentially an infinite number of times every moment of every day. We do it all the time. And what I found is as we get older, we start taking shortcuts. We go from if this, and this, then that, to just if this, than that. Or sometimes we just go, that. Now, it's important to point out that when we just jump to that, this inference is actually based on no data. It bears no relation to where we are at that moment. We've already left the moment. It's not an inference any longer. It's a preconception. Now, I'm struck that there are two important characteristics of pattern recognition. These are sort of unfortunate characteristics of pattern recognition. The first is that we get very attached to our predictions. And we start to believe that the prediction, which is something that came out of our mind, is actually the reality in which we're embedded. Even if our predictions are repeatedly proven incorrect, we still continue to believe it. You know, there's a thing in science that's called theory tenacity. And so scientists come up with theories about things. And they, like with everything else, we just can't let go. Even if you're repeatedly shown that your theory doesn't work, you can't let it go. And maybe you continue to write papers about this theory that's been disproved over and over again. So it's called theory tenacity. I think we do that in life a lot. So that's the first unfortunate characteristic. We just sort of glom onto these inferences and in many cases supplant reality with these inferences. The second unfortunate characteristic is that our predictions inevitably engender value judgments. If this and this, then that. But you know, I don't really like that. It's ugly. You do that too. We all do this. It's ugly, or it's stupid, or it's wrong, or it's boring, or it's pretentious, or it's tacky, or something. Or conversely, I really like those shoes. Or what an interesting person, or what a cool car, or a beautiful flower, or delicious green tea, or what a great sitting I just had. And finally, there is an incredibly large percentage of the 10,000 things that are not factored into our predictions at all because we don't see them. Or we do see them and we ignore them. And we ignore them because we're focused on the stuff we like or we don't like. And we do this, now, just as a parenthetical aside, when I say we do this, I'm really talking about I do this. I guess that's sort of an unstated thing about the Dharma talks. I'm talking about myself. And we do this all the time from one moment to the next, forming a continual stream of opinions and value judgments which about everything and everyone we come in contact with. We just do it all the time with everything. And these judgments are what we paint our world with. And by the end of the day, everything that I have come in contact with has been carefully and meticulously painted Chuck. So if we go back to this line from the Sandokai, the brightness distinguishes good and bad phrases. The brightness, which we can interpret as the mental light that we shine out and illuminate the entire world, it indeed distinguishes good and bad phrases because we create these distinctions. And I think the ancestors are pretty clear about the value of going through life with a judgmental paintbrush in your hand. To give one example, from Seng San, the third Chinese patriarch, this is 14 years ago. So this was written 1,400 years ago. This is from Faith and Mind of the Xinqing Ming. We've Many of us have probably read this, heard this. The great way is not difficult. It just precludes picking and choosing. Without yearning or loathing, the way is perfectly apparent. While even a hairbreadth difference separates heaven and earth. To see the way with your own eyes, quit agreeing and disagreeing. The battling of likes and dislikes, that's the disease of the mind. I really love this. Misunderstanding the great mystery, people labor in vain for peace. Mine has the totality of space, nothing lacking, nothing extra. It's just selecting and rejecting that makes it seem otherwise. And then in the translation that I was reading, which was Nelson Foster from Entering the Stream, there's a line that says, there's no need to seek the truth, just put a stop to your opinions with an exclamation point after that. If you don't conceive even oneness of mind, the 10,000 things are flawless. In this flawlessness, there's nothing at all, no conception, no mind. The subject disappears with its objects, and objects vanish without a subject. Now, to me, there's a lot in this piece, but two things in particular sort of resonate with me. The first of these is that picking and choosing and opining and painting are clearly viewed as distractions, the sources of delusion along the great way. The 10,000 things of which we are one are flawless without these. We have just painted over everything. The second is the whole pattern recognition, value judgment, response to life's moments occur because of sort of a dualistic subject-object context that we cling so strongly to. That there's me, and then there's everything else outside of me. Some of which I like and some of which I don't like, and the great majority of which I don't even consider. So I'm living my life on autopilot based on a really, really, really small sample size. I'm shutting everything out. Rarely do I see things and phenomena as they really are, and which leads me to think that maybe everything in my world is not better painted, Chuck. This could be happening in your world as well. And as long as I maintain this subject-object context, I live with the delusion that I'm the only one who can see the paint that I've spread all over the world. I'm going around making messes, but I think it's okay because I'm the only one that can see it. Which, of course, is patently incorrect. Here, like everywhere else, there are consequences to my action. You may remember dependent co-arising. Dennis gave a really beautiful talk on that last Sunday. He actually called it pratitya samutpada. So if we come back to the Xin Qing Ming, this wonderful line, the subject disappears with its objects, objects vanish without a subject. This is interesting. What would happen if I stopped continually painting everything? As with most things, Master Dogen has some very useful words to offer on this topic. From the second paragraph of Genjo Koan, to carry yourself forward and illuminate the myriad things, the myriad dharmas, is delusion. That the myriad things come forth and illuminate themselves as awakening or enlightenment. Dogen states quite clearly here that to carry yourself forward, paintbrush in hand, and illuminate the myriad things is delusion. And this is how many of us live our life. We project ourselves with our opinions, our value judgments, and our inferences onto all the people, things, and phenomena that make up our lives. We imagine ourselves as a subject, observing and manipulating a world that is outside of us and separate from us. So we're in here, and you're not there. And I'm painting all of this. And when we do this, we're just painting, painting, painting. It's like we're painting over the windows of our house. So we're trapping ourselves inside, and we can't see out of our house, and we can't fully experience what is going on outside. All we can see are our inferences about what might be outside. And I find that this is sad because all of our houses have really beautiful views outside that we can't see. On the other hand, Dogen says that when we allow the myriad things to come forward and illuminate themselves, we are able to see them as they really are. And this exchange does not occur in the subject-object world. It's not that the objects are coming forth and experiencing or controlling or creating me. We are reciprocally creating each other. Subject, me, drops the paintbrush, disappears, and becomes one with whatever it is that has come forth. And together, we become an essential part of that beautiful view that surrounds our house. To manifest what is essential in the situation in front of us, it's like the mahogany tree growing in that Amazonian rainforest. Something presents itself. It can be a light gap or a hungry herbivore or a torrential rainstorm. And the tree responds in exactly the most appropriate way. And the most appropriate way to continue growing and to maintain the integrity of the larger community within which it finds itself is like the essential response to whatever it is. To fully manifest what is essential in the situation in front of us without using any paint. This is one of the things that we learn, I think, from our sitting practice and gradually carry out into the world. We sit, and things come up, and we don't grab them or push them away or ignore them. These are definitely good life lessons that we learn. Now, sometimes manifesting the essential thing will involve a recognized pattern. Waiting to cross the street until the sign says walk, or giving a lot of room to a dog that's growling at you. That actually happened to me yesterday. Recognize patterns that inform the way we interact with things in our life. In most moments of our life, however, manifesting what is essential requires us to appreciate the inherent thusness of the myriad things as they come forward without any conditioned response on our part, without the recognized pattern. It requires us to be fully present in all aspects of our life without picking or choosing, and to share our deepest wholesomeness with the world. Each and every one of us here is perfect and precious, and we are all inextricably woven together in a boundless net of conditions and dependencies. We are not just our opinions and our desires and our preconceptions. And you know, we all look better when we're not splattered with paint. I'd like to close with a short poem by Jane Hirschfield. And she wrote this after spending an extended period at the Tassajara Center in the mountains of California, in a period where she didn't have any electricity. This is from a collection of poems by her, Acetary Fragrance. And the poem says, "Even now, decades after, I wash my face with cold water. Not for discipline, nor memory, nor the icy awakening slap, but to practice choosing to make the unwanted wanted." Thank you.